and Francesca present Seva Matrimony.
Welcome to another episode of Seva Matrimony. I am Matt Scalisi, and joining me as always is Francesca, my lovely wife, although she's not feeling her best right now, so she may sound a bit less, I don't know, what would you say, a bit less sort of fervent than usual?
I would say a bit more like Jabba the Hutt, since that is how I'm laying on the couch.
I don't think that's how you sound.
I don't know. Blah. So.
Anyways, she's going to be brave and make a go of it anyway. And we should say up front, we did not use our usual format of seeing this movie together. We saw it separately. We had to take turns to see it. And both of which were in less than ideal conditions. Francesca, you were already not feeling very well when you saw this movie. And I saw this movie at a 10:30 p.m. screening, which means it probably started at 11, and I got out of the theater at about 1:30 in the morning. So
I'll tell you something else that detracted from my experience was when I had messaged you, I said, oh, private screening. But no, three people came in. Two of them came in together, and one of the gentlemen was handicapped, so they sat in the front row. Great.
God, great. Handicapped people.
My point is, I have no issue with them. My issue is with the third guy who came in, 10 minutes in the movie, and then like a major creeper came and sat like behind me. So I spent most of the movie thinking that somebody was going to strangle me from behind.
I thought you were going to say he came up and was like, what did I miss?
No. Oh, God. That would have been even worse. But
that's
so
true.
I was like,
if you had to describe the beginning and what he missed.
Oh, my gosh. And actually, as it turned out, when
Don't worry.
Like, every time he moved, I was like, he's moving towards me. He's going to kill me. Don't. Word to the wise. If you're a gentleman and you come into a movie 10 minutes late and it's a really sparsely filled-in theater and there's
sit
a woman
as far
sitting
away
in,
as possible from everyone else.
Like,
as
the
you
problem
can.
Was, if he had just sat, like, I was in, like, the back third of the theater where I prefer to be. And if he had just sat, like, in front of me, he still could have had, I think he went to the back row, but he was, like, too close behind me that I could see him peripherally. Oh, it was not a good experience.
All right, well,
I was on edge.
Moving on to the actual movie itself, which is The Master, we should say.
Oh yeah.
And for those who are not regular listeners, this is a spoiler-filled podcast. We will talk about details of the movie. So if you've not seen it and you don't want to know things about it, then stop listening.
All those incredible plot twists.
Now listen, I knew you were going to go there, but this movie. I will say, Francesca, I agree. I probably agree with you that the ending leaves you feeling a little unsatisfied.
You don't know anything about what I
don't know what you feel.
Don't put words in my mouth,
but
son.
I don't really know how you could say that nothing happens in this movie. Lots of stuff happens in this movie. But since we have not talked about it at all, why don't you sort of break the ice and just say your immediate reaction?
PTA, as I like to call him. I don't like to call him that. I'm just calling him that for right now because I'm so ill. I can't say his whole name. He makes beautiful films. He makes films that don't look like anyone else's. He does a weird thing where he kind of, the visuals you've never seen before, but the music sort of has a very lush and orchestrated feeling. So you kind of are like, I know I'm in a film, but he's doing kind of gritty things. Anyways, he makes a good film. I don't really like his films at all. And this cemented that for me. That's the dumbest thing. I don't like his movies.
Because I paused it and made you restart your
yes,
sentence?
Yes, you did. That's the dumbest thing I ever did here on a podcast that I don't listen to. I remember liking Magnolia, and I liked There Will Be Blood, but I've never, ever been like, I really want to watch that again. And this movie, I definitely, of all of them, I really didn't like this movie. And in part, it felt very meandering. But I think at the end of the day, him as a director, I just don't care about his characters. Like, I'm interested to see what they do, but I am not invested in them at all. Like, if everyone had died at the end of this movie, I wouldn't have cared. Not a bit. I wouldn't have cared one bit.
I don't think he
bit.
Wants you to be emotionally invested
well,
in his characters.
Well, to me, so that's what I'm saying.
They're interesting.
To me, I would like to be emotionally invested in the people who I'm watching 3 hours of film about, you know? I mean, like I said, it was interesting sometimes, but some of it just, it was tiresome.
I guess I see your point about that, but
he makes cold movies. They're beautiful,
yeah.
And he's doing a lot of interesting stuff, but they're cold. I don't want to see him again. I don't want to spend time with these people anymore.
I would say that there's a range of things that I enjoy watching, and sometimes I don't want a cloying movie that's begging me to be emotionally invested in everybody involved.
That's not always cloying. If it's done well, you know, it kind of sneaks in, and you suddenly realize, like, oh, I care about these people. Because there are plenty of movies where they're unlikable characters who you suddenly what was it called? Young Adult. Like, Mavis was terrible, but you are invested in her in a way that I'm not invested in any of these characters. Now, I will say also going
It's a totally different kind of filmmaking, though. Like,
I'm just saying, it is possible to make unlikable characters people you're emotionally invested in. And I think Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't.
I think he makes likable characters sometimes. And there aren't really any in this movie.
I know, but I'm saying I'm not emotionally invested in characters. Like I said, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm saying this from having seen all of his movies once. And
no,
but
I don't
because
think
I'm not compelled to watch any of them.
I don't think you're off base with that description. Although I do think that
Not saying that makes them bad movies. I'm saying that's making them movies that I don't like.
No, I understand. But I do think his career has taken a turn that this movie has a lot in common with There Will Be Blood. And I think those two movies kind of feel different than the rest of the movies he's made. Obviously, there's similarities, but you could kind of set them apart. And they're even colder than the rest of his movies.
Well, but I will tell you, I like There Will Be Blood a lot more than this. And this,
why do you think you liked it more?
Because the actors, I recognize that Philip Seymour Hoffman.
You think the performances were better?
Stay with me. Let me finish a sentence. I recognize that Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix and even Amy Adams, I thought, put in a good performance here. And Amy Adams is not really who my beef is with. But I don't like watching Philip Seymour Hoffman, like, in anything. I think I recognize that he's a really good actor, but he's not an actor I like to watch.
That's the first.
And I don't like watching Joaquin Phoenix, actually, either.
That's the first time I've ever heard someone say they don't like Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Well, somebody very, I don't remember, I think maybe this was on a Nerdist podcast. I was listening to something, and somebody made this very valid point. Oh, no, I think it might have been on Film Fandango, actually, that with some actors, you can feel them working hard, and even if it's effective, you can feel it. And then there's people like, they use the example of Carey Mulligan in An Education, that it's like you don't know how she's doing something amazing, but you don't see how it's happening. And I feel like Philip Seymour Hoffman is somebody who's definitely acting, but he's like acting with a capital A, and it's not bad. It's just something that's uncomfortable for me to watch. And I think that Daniel Day-Lewis, on the other hand, is someone who's like, you buy him 100% as the character. You're not going like, oh, he's doing a really good job acting. You're going like, it's Daniel Plainview.
Well, I don't entirely agree with that, but I do think that Philip Seymour Hoffman is a very...
But there's just something like abrasive about him.
He
I just don't like to watch
Well,
him.
he's very Marlon Brando sort of feel to him, where he really rarely plays an understated character, although he has. And in Magnolia, he kind of does.
And honestly, this may be just petty of me, but like I don't like watching his face.
Well, look,
I don't know.
Like, there's nothing you can say about that. There are some people that we just don't like. I like Philip Seymour Hoffman. It seems like most people do.
No, and I'm saying like I think he's good in everything I've seen him in. I think he's a very talented actor, but I'm never like, I gotta see that new Philip Seymour Hoffman movie. I wanna see what he pulls out next, you know. And Joaquin Phoenix, I just couldn't understand him. Which, I mean, maybe it was a character choice, but honestly, the first half an hour of the movie, I'm like, what is he saying? He's just so mumbly. I don't understand what the words are coming out of his mouth.
Well, he didn't really say anything the first half hour of the movie.
He was talking. There was talking going on. And
well,
he was like,
so outside of these aesthetic beefs, let's actually
what is
talk
the film about aesthetics?
A plot and character development.
Well,
and
I didn't
like
think
that.
Those were particularly interesting.
Well, I want to actually talk
the thing,
about
you
them.
You say
though.
Plot. Like, there was like some beginning, middle, and end, and there just really wasn't.
There is. It's the story of this guy and his first. I mean, we get lots of details about his life, but mostly the movie is the story of the part of his life where he is involved with this sort of loopy, charlatan-esque religious leader. It's not really a cult because they don't really ever do anything dangerous, but it's, you know, it's
well,
that sort
of getting people to reveal, like, you know,
Yeah, they're not
about themselves.
They're not hurting anybody though. They're mostly probably taking people's money. They're trying to get people to buy their book and
that's hurting people.
Yeah.
To deceive them into thinking you're
right, but I'm saying it's not Jim Jones. They're not gonna all drink the Kool-Aid at some point.
I would say that maybe that is what they're doing. If you buy into it and spend all your money and believe it. I mean, I think that's what the whole point of Laura Dern, literally drinking Kool-Aid and dying.
Yes, I
know what you're talking about, but I'm saying, you know, Laura Dern, that whole thing was basically she was ready to throw it all away and follow him, and he snapped on her because
right.
she was very kindly pointing out a discrepancy, but asking, like, you know, like, so is this the way we do it now? Like, is that,
right?
You know, and he lost his mind on her.
Well, and I think there's a lot more, it's not really quite as much about him, about Lancaster Dodd, as it is about the Joaquin Phoenix character.
Right, which, so what happens with him? They drive him, they basically make him crazy. Like, he starts out crazy, and then they make him walk back and forth between a wall and a window for 6 days or whatever.
I think they don't really accomplish anything. I think I think it's really difficult, and, like, really my main beef with this is that I don't think it goes anywhere, and I don't think it has a...
That's kind of what I said.
No, you said nothing happens, which is very different than anywhere.
I said there's no beginning, middle, and end.
There is a beginning and a middle, and there is an end. It's just that the end doesn't have any impact for me.
Like, it's never made abundantly clear why Philip Seymour Hoffman is so engaged by him. Other than that...
Yeah, I don't really know either.
Perhaps there's some sort of perversity in that he is exactly what he's saying human beings shouldn't be, this all animalistic and all, you know, id. And so maybe he's, like, perversely attracted to him because he's surrounded by all these yes men who are the opposite, and he's all just, you know.
See, I think he took it I think he's a very confident guy, or he's that sort of mix of confident and really terrified that he's going to fail. And I think that this guy that he happens upon is sort of the perfect test case where he says, okay, if what I'm saying, if I'm who I think I am, I should be able to change this guy. And I think he's simultaneously interested in him because maybe, like you said, he sort of represents the opposite of what the cause is supposed to be about.
Honestly, and unexpectedly, the character I'm most interested in, which we knew more about, is the Amy Adams character, actually.
Yeah, we really don't know anything about her.
Because she was sort of ended up being really very much a villain and, like...
Do you think so?
She was kind of very anti-Freddie Quell, but I think in being so, she sort of spurred on Lancaster to do kind of... I mean, because they were, like, kind of cruel to him. Like, once they kind of redoubled their efforts, they were really making him crazy.
Well, she was
doubting...
They were
doing nonsense things and making him do them over and over again and pretending like
I think they think that works. I think they've come to believe that method does something.
And can we talk about how creepy it was when he just made her eyes go black just to...
That was great. But you know what? That was one example of a couple of times in the movie where... it's made clear to us that some of what we're seeing is not really what's happening, and it is a subjective, it's Freddie Quell's perspective, and thus we can't really trust it. The other one off the top of my head being...
The dancing naked people?
The party scene.
By the way, cute how you were like, there is a little bit of perviness in it, Francesca, but not much, don't worry about it.
I shot you a quick warning.
Yeah, a quick warning. So I'm expecting like a boob shot. It's like 50% boobs, this movie.
It's not.
And it's a little bit of full frontal and, you know, boning a sand lady. So
boning the sand lady is not really that bad.
It's upsetting. It is perverse.
Yeah.
If you're talking about pervy, that's a pretty pervy moment in a film.
Well, it's more like gross. It's not like erotic filmmaking.
Let us not forget that the film actually ends with him next to a sand nipple.
That's true.
That's the last shot of the film. So,
you know, can I tell you a little bit about our friends who've already opined on this movie a great deal? First of all, and I'm sorry.
Oh, I know
to them.
There's going
to
be angry text lobbed at me.
Well, no, maybe not.
Again, I have said, and I will say it until the day I die, it's a well-made film. I don't like it, and that's all I'm working
that's
from.
Fine.
Is if I liked it or not, and
I
like it.
I will tell you first of all, and I apologize to the nerds that I'm about to mention if I mischaracterize their opinion, but One bit of Graham Flanagan's YouTube review that he did of the movie is he does think that it was very hard for him to connect to it. He felt he felt sort of distant. He felt like it didn't make the same emotional impact on him that There Will Be Blood did. And I think Ben Flanagan and Corey agree with that. But also, Ben's sort of reading, and he and I talked about it a little bit, is that sort of the whole thing comes back to Doris, the young girlfriend, and that, that's what all the sort of, like, Sandwoman, all the stuff that he's looking for in the cause, he's trying to replace the sort of gap in his life that Doris left.
16-year-old girl.
Right. Well, whatever.
Well, that's pretty significant.
I don't think it was that unusual for World War II era. I think there were some 16-year-old sweethearts of World War II soldiers.
Yeah, but didn't you get a sense from that flashback that, like, Doris was not as committed to that relationship?
Yeah, I don't think she was.
Like, she wrote him letters as sort of because she was a girl, as, like, right, a flight of fancy, not, like, because she wanted to start a right, meaningful relationship with him particularly.
Well, and obviously she didn't, like, wait around for him or anything. But I don't think it really matters from his point of view, because, you know, he's just sort of he's driven by his base impulses anyway. He doesn't really care if the other person reciprocates or not.
Well, no, but I think that was supposed to be the difference, was that she was the one he actually cared about.
Right.
And so that was, you know, I mean, I guess the point is he goes and finds out she's married with kids, so he's broken, and that's why he goes back. I didn't even really get, was it so, they were like, okay, drive as fast as you can at a point. Is that when he left?
I don't know.
I don't understand. There was so much about it. And I know this isn't just me being dumb, but I do like answers in my movies. Nebulousness is not something I enjoy.
Well, I don't know if it's entirely clear when that scene is happening. That scene could happen before several other things that we've already seen in the movie. So I don't really know. I do think that the sort of verdict a lot of people are coming away with on this is that this movie just does not connect. And even Corey and Ben, who I don't think are wanting to be negative about it, are saying, well, I think I just need to see it a few more times. And I told them, I don't think they're giving themselves enough credit. I think if you don't feel a connection the first time you see a movie, you can get things from a movie on repeat viewings, but I think you're going to get the main thrust of it. You're going to get it the first time you see it. And if you don't, then I don't think the filmmaker did his job.
Yeah, the perfect example of the opposite side of the spectrum is There Will Be Blood. I left, and I put a big old smile on my face, and I was like, I don't even know why I like that movie so much.
You liked it so much. Right.
Which, again, I'm kind of chalking it up to, a lot going to the performances in that film versus these ones. I mean, also, obviously, like, screenplay does play a big part, but I know personal preference-wise, these are not two guys that I particularly want to spend 2.5 hours watching.
What did you think about the scene? Because I know now, from hearing you, you obviously don't really like spending time with these characters, and you find them abrasive as actors, but I would say there's a few scenes in the movie that I would say are probably the scenes that would be Oscar clips, so to speak. The processing on the boat.
Yeah, that was a really good scene.
Awesome scene. And I think I've heard Paul Thomas Anderson say that was actually the first scene he wrote. He wrote that before he knew the characters' names, even, basically.
Yeah, that was pretty, they were acting their butts off there, and I will give them credit for that.
And Joaquin Phoenix is so violent in this movie. I mean, there's stuff where I think, like, he must have hurt himself.
Oh,
like,
yeah, when he's in the jail cell.
When he kicks that toilet.
Well, and when he's, like, banging his head against the top bunk. Also, was he putting on a gait? Like, because he walked, like, really, like,
no,
caved in, like, his shoulders were rolled forward.
He was, I'm going, like, I may be missing some details here. I think Joaquin Phoenix was born with some physical deformities.
No, the only thing he had was a cleft palate.
No, that's, I'm saying, outside of that, he was like one of those cases, like Martin Sheen had this, where they had to, like, break his shoulders when he was born.
Your wife had that too, and I am a beautiful specimen of a
right.
human
being. I think for older people, it didn't quite go as
no,
easily.
But I feel like he was putting that on though. He was kind of hunched over.
Was, but I think there's some amount of it that's natural to him because he has some natural physical issues.
I don't think though. I think
no. I'm telling you, I've heard it in very recent interviews that he was drawing on issues that he already has and that he sort of works to correct.
Yeah.
But yeah, and the talking out of the side of his mouth, that's sort of something that could be a natural proclivity for him anyway, since he has the sort of the little, you know, the surgical marks on his mouth.
Yeah, cleft palate.
Right. It was a performance that was like very transforming. If you've ever seen him in anything else, it's like it's a different person.
Yeah, I mean, again, like I say, they were both acting real good. Maybe just some real good acting. But it's not my cup of tea acting. So what do you want from me? I cut my teeth on musical.
No,
theater.
I don't have
I like what I like.
I don't take issue with anything you've said, because I do think at the end of the day, I think a lot of people are going to find that this movie just does not hit them at the gut level, and I think it's probably going to hurt its chances to be the sort of runaway emotional favorite for the best picture, because Paul Thomas Anderson has a certain aspect to him where he has become a thing where if you don't like him, you're not cool. And if you don't like one of his movies, you're not cool.
As I am already not cool. I don't really care.
No, but...
And by the way, here's the thing that kept on running through my head. How did this man not write warm characters? He's married to Maya Rudolph, who's probably the only celebrity who I think if I saw her and I was like, can I give you a hug? She'd probably be like, yes, and embrace me warmly. She's one of the most like earthy people, it seems like.
Because it's an intellectual exercise and it's a movie about dark people.
Let's throw this out there. It's a movie about intellectual exercise, and maybe that's why we're not connecting with it. It's not it's a movie based on like trickery and, you know.
What do you mean?
I mean, The Cause, you know, it's just a made up thing. And so we, the audience, know it's a made up thing, so we're never really invested in that whole thing, which is like the point of the movie.
Is this just about
like we're never going like, yeah, well,
what
this
about movies? What about movies about con men though? There can be some very warm movies about con men.
Matchstick Men.
I was going to say, like, The Sting. Like, a Best Picture winner, but Matchstick Men was all right.
Well, I know, but I'm saying, I guess maybe it's because it's something nobody can relate to, but also, like, there just wasn't that human element to it. Like, all the sum of its parts were people being deceptive, and it was either, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman knowing he was being deceptive, or people buying into his deception, but any way you slice it, it's not really something that we, the audience, ever buy into.
Well, I guess here's what it hits on with me as a human being, if you want to get in that side of it. First of all...
Boobies.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I think that, first of all, as somebody who has had... I would consider, and you tell me, as someone who lives with me...
Okay.
Wouldn't you say that I perhaps have difficulty controlling my emotions sometimes?
Yes.
Yeah, so see, and I don't think that's an uncommon problem. So I think that there's some part of me that identifies with Joaquin Phoenix and sees like, okay, well, that's a person who is really desperate. He cannot control his emotions, but in his case, he really doesn't care, and he has no... reason to want to try to control them. And then on the other side, you have this guy who, and I think we all have this in us as well. We kind of, our dual nature, the Philip Seymour Hoffman character thinks he's got it all figured out. And he has that confidence of somebody who believes he has all the answers. And then basically, as soon as a crack appears in the plan, he gets really angry and frustrated and starts to lose control a little bit. And I think that's something that I can identify with too. Obviously, they're extreme examples, but I do think those are human emotions and experiences. Maybe they're particularly male. Maybe that's why it hit with me a little bit more than you did, because those do seem like very male things, don't you think?
Very you things.
Well, I'm saying I don't think it's unique in me. I think those are male traits, But yeah, this is a very, in general, this is a very male-oriented movie, and I do think I bet, even though I'm saying it didn't really connect that well with me, and I think our other friends say that too, I think it probably will connect a little bit better with a male audience than a female audience.
Man, I was all excited. I'm going to the movies on an afternoon. This is awesome.
I know. We should have just seen Looper, don't you think?
Yes. Well, a thousand times yes.
That'll be our next podcast, man, is Looper.
I want to see Looper all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know,
you're not going to like Looper, though. It's
I'm going to love Looper.
It's time travel. You hate time travel.
No,
movies.
I hate you. Just kidding. Aww. No, but I do. I love you. No, I totally. I like JGL. Come on. I like Bruce Willis. You know, I always talk about
B-dubs.
He's the lost Roscoe brother. He looks like my uncles. He looks like he could fit right in there with my dad and his four brothers.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of warmth for him. Emily Blunt is blonde, so that'll be interesting.
Emily Blunt's in that movie?
She is.
Here's why I didn't know that.
Jeff, what's his
because
face?
I don't know what Emily Blunt looks like still. Still.
All right, whatever.
She is a blank face.
Is it Jeff? Who am I thinking of?
What are you talking about?
Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges is in this movie?
I think so.
I don't think you're right.
I think I am right.
All
right.
Well, I guess we'll find out.
I don't think I'm right. Well.
It's a podcast. It's going to be really funny if Jeff Bridges is not in Looper. And you're
It's going to be really funny when he is, and you're wrong.
All right. Well, I'll look it up afterwards.
Yeah, and I'll dance in my head because I'm laid up like an invalid.
Oh, yeah. Well. Anyway, I kind of wish we had more to say about it, but I think we just kind of both left feeling flat about The Master, you know?
Yes. Like I said, there were a few things going in, one of which, thinking I was going to get murdered in a movie theater was part of it.
Yeah.
That was part of the problem, from my experience.
Have you ever... Which Paul Thomas Anderson movies have you seen?
I have seen Punch-Drunk Love. I have seen Magnolia. I have seen There Will Be Blood. I have seen this one. What other ones does he have?
That's basically it. Boogie Nights and Heart 8, but I doubt you would have
I haven't seen either of those. Listen, I know what Boogie Nights is about. Not interested.
It is not. It's actually, it's probably not what you think.
Well, there is a lot of peen in it, so.
Heart 8 is really good, actually. You would like it.
Yeah, well, no, I probably wouldn't.
Oh, actually, no, you wouldn't because it's a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. But
I did like Magnolia.
It's good.
Okay.
It's good.
But maybe that's mostly because I like Amy Mann.
Yeah. Tom Cruise. One of his better
performances. That's pretty sketch of him to go after old Scientology.
He didn't really, though. This movie is not really about Scientology.
No, it's a... Very, processing is like a thing.
Yeah, it's very broadly.
What do they call it? Auditing?
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, it's only controversial about Scientology if you accept that Scientology is made up and one dude was BSing his way through it. And I think everybody who doesn't belong to Scientology believes that anyway.
Yeah.
So 99% of us that see that movie, it's not controversial. It's not like he's horribly offending Scientologists by saying, oh yeah, this one dude that wrote some science fiction books made your religion up, because he did. But
yeah. Good night.
Is that all you got?
We should give a thank you to our friends at CinemaJaw, and we should also give a plug, not just because we were on it, but because it's a good podcast. And
yeah.
You should be listening to it.
Yeah,
but
we
also
would.
We were on it, so whatever.
Everybody go visit cinemajaw.com and
or search for them on iTunes.
And on either their most recent episode, if you're hearing this, new, or if you're perusing our back catalog, it's I believe we were episode 126. Something like that. But yeah, we're the Vigilante episode, and it's a very fun podcast. It's very sort of fast paced, lots of cool, fun segments, and Francesca and I were on it, and we had a good time.
Yeah,
and I think you would if you listened. But we're gonna be trying to make some improvements pretty soon here at Film Nerds, one of which already is that you don't have to look at that ugly homepage anymore. If you go to filmnerds.com, it now just comes straight to
the blog.
Our lovely blog.
Lovely.
Like, it's better than the homepage was. But in the meantime, we're also going to be working on the podcast feed on iTunes, going to make that more relevant and up to date. And everybody, please.
And also, we might see some movies sometimes, which we haven't done in a long time.
Well, hopefully there'll be more of those coming soon. So, all right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us. And we will see you next time. Goodbye, Francesca.
Matt, we're going to sit here and watch TV.
Yeah.
Why'd you say goodbye to me?
Because in the digital world, we're about to turn off.
We're married. They know we live together.
All right.
How about goodbye, world?
Okay. Bye.